humanity are caught up in systems and circumstances that do not allow for a great deal of choices. Example, say I am working for Mennonite Central Committee in Haiti or Harlan, Kentucky, both areas of high poverty, for 3 years. I am living among poverty, but I am myself not poor. Why am I not poor? Because at any moment, I can leave the situation. I have the power and the choice to come or go, to pursue a career or education or buy a house or go out to eat. People in poverty don't have those choices, or they have very limited ones. They are stuck by the systems they live in, or by the circumstances they find themselves in, or in some cases, the limitations of their own mental framework, the mindset of poverty. So let's go with not having options and choices as a working definition of poverty this morning. Let's also remember, as I said, that poverty is a complex issue. And those of you, like I say, who deal more directly with it can educate me about that. Now, if you are rich with the power of choice and possibility, you also have access to what is, I think, a fundamental element of spiritual health. The largest word for that is love, but there is another word right below that I'm wondering if you might think about. What is that word that allows one that people not in poverty have? Any idea? Anybody dare to yell? What? Enough? Yes, you have the luxury of enough. Remember the virtues of certain spiritual virtues. One of them, I'm going to suggest, is hope. When you have enough, you have hope. When you don't have enough, it diminishes hope. And I think that is one of the luxuries it's not a luxury, it's actually a necessity for all human beings. We all need a sense of hope that there is a future for us, that things can get better, that we do have agency over our life and we can effect change. People in the most extreme poverty situations are deprived of hope. Hope to have their basic needs met. Hope to provide for their children's well-being. Hope for advancement economically. Hope for dignity. Hope for discovering and developing their talents and gifts. People truly in the condition of poverty are generally only surviving. And that may be the only hope they have. It's just to hold on one day at a time. That's poverty. And this is a condition that is truly, I think, an abomination to the Lord. As I've said before, and I'll say it again, God wants us to not just to survive, but to thrive, to do well. And if all of God's creation is not thriving, really none of us are. We're all diminished by poverty. We are all bound together. I don't think that's a spiritual truth that the Christian theology has grabbed hold of as well as it could have, but I think it's true. We are all bound together on some level. We have lost sight of that. And by not acknowledging this reality of our interconnection, we are able to ignore or tolerate poverty. As Paul said, if one suffers, the entire body suffers. Now, I know Paul is referring to the church, the body of the church, but I believe that same principle applies to the whole of creation itself. We are all God's children. Now, if Jim Wallace is correct in his count, and I have over 2,000 biblical verses to choose from for preaching on this topic this morning, why did I choose Proverbs 37-9? Well, I'll tell you why. Rhetorical question. I chose it because it seems to capture the essence of the situation. First of all, this proverb is a prayer to God. It is a prayer of request for only two things. Take away from me falsehood and lies, and give me neither poverty or riches. The first request asks for seeing things the way they are. It's saying, show me the truth, God. Show me the world as it is. Show me what I need to see. Take away the scales from my eyes. Help me to put aside my agenda and my judgment so that I may see the truth about the world and about myself in that world. As it applies to poverty, help me to see and learn what the reality of poverty is. Help me to know the truth of poverty, even if it's painful, by hearing the stories from someone who is living it. Let them, those who are experiencing suffering, be the sacred word to me. Speak to me through their suffering and let the poor be my teachers. Come, Holy Spirit, come. For the little time I have in this world, show me the truth I need to see. To me, that is the essence of a prayer that says, do not let me settle for falsehoods. The powerful parable Jesus told of the rich man and Lazarus illustrates this well. Recall that story? It's the parable Jesus tells of the very, very rich man who walks by poor Lazarus, destitute and poor, the poor beggar, every day, only to regret it in the afterlife deeply that he did not notice or do anything about the situation he was walking by. The lesson of this parable is that the rich man was blind to the truth of poor Lazarus's plight. The rich man's prayer was, if he had one, not to be shown the truth of the reality
by every day. The desire to see the reality before him wasn't high on his prayer list.
Otherwise, been troubled by it, at the very least. You see, we cannot address anything until we are willing to be open to the truth and get beyond the false myths we tell ourselves. When it comes to poverty, we all tend to live by partial truths. We tell ourselves that the poor are lazy, and that is why they're poor. Or we tell ourselves that if only people apply themselves more, they can rise above poverty. We tell ourselves that we are self-made people and we have made good choices and have worked hard. Now, all of these statements have some truth to them. Some people, rich and poor, are lazy. Some people, rich and poor, do make terrible choices. Some people, rich and poor, can rise above their poverty through sheer determination. Some people have resiliency and some don't. Some people, rich and poor, do make choices that do lead them toward prosperity. But like I said in the beginning of the sermon, from what I can see, poverty is complex. I have to be humble and to remember that I benefit personally, Gary Jewell, by being born white and male. I had the benefit of a middle-class upbringing. I had the benefit of parents who never broke up and maintained a fairly functional household. I live in a society that was and still is designed to favor those who fit into my demographic. Therefore, with these advantages, I have many options and choices to stay out of poverty. But even then, one major health crisis or one major economic catastrophe could potentially knock any of us into the poverty column. No fault of our own, and the system is driving more of the middle class in our current times into the poverty category. Globally, there has never been greater gaps between the extremely wealthy and the extremely poor. I'm not going to bore you with the stats, but they are astounding. I believe three factors, and this is just my opinion, but three factors are driving this trend of economic fragility. One is lack of good health care for everyone. The second thing is affordable higher education. And the third is a lack of minimal guaranteed livable wage, whereby anyone working a full day or a full 40-hour week job can support their family. Now, these were all conditions under which I grew up, and most of you did too. But those conditions do not exist today. Yet these are conditions that allow anyone, everyone, regardless of political persuasion or religious conviction, to potentially at least live up to their full potential. These are not issues the church can fix. We do charity in the church, but we also need to do advocacy to our government, to the higher powers. In the name of Christ, mind you, but we are called to help the poor not be poor any longer. And these are big, big collective problems that the church alone will not be able to solve. I hope our prayer will be, Lord, remove from me all falsehood. Help me to see poverty as it is and my connection to it. I hope that anything I say on this matter is true, but it may not be. I recognize that too. You can educate me, I'm sure. I want to suggest too that culture makes a difference when it comes to poverty. In general, there are some differences to when it comes to immigrant and domestic culture in the topic of poverty. Recently, our president famously referred to immigrants by saying they are bringing in drugs, they are bringing in crime, they are rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. Now, I think he could have truthfully said, a few are bringing in drugs and crime, but most are good, honest, family-loving, America-loving, God-loving, hard-working people. That would have been a more helpful and accurate statement. A quick testimony to this point. As some of you know, my wife Jan, she works with young first-time mothers who are on the poverty scale somewhere. She deals one-on-one with families over the course of the child's first 2 years of life and with their families. And she deals with all flavors of poverty. But by far the ones she finds that have the most vitality are the immigrant families and mothers. Many have emotional and spiritual resources of extended family. Many have a partner who is hardworking. Some hold down two or three jobs while getting further education. Most are extremely motivated to take advantage of every opportunity they can, having survived through crazy, horrendous situations in their home countries where there were no opportunities. These folks have a good chance of moving out of the poverty column. They have spiritual riches that help them move up. But many of the folks my wife worked with have multi-generational poverty. The family is broken up. Addictions have taken their toll. Role models of low expectations and hopelessness are deeply embedded. These cases are multi-layered and complex and are very difficult to transcend despite a few modest supports they are offered. Their poverty is systematic and must be addressed on the systematic level. The good news is that these things are fixable. We can change these things, but only, I think, on a collective level. When all do well, we all do well. Of course, Jesus said, there will always be the poor among you. We know that. But we also know that Jesus said, when you do these to the least of these, you've done them for me. Put that up against his final promise while he was on this earth. Truly, I am with you, even to the end of the age. Now, string those three sayings together. If the poor will always be among us, and Jesus is found among the poor, and Jesus promises to always be with us, then it stands to reason that we don't get any closer to ministering to Jesus than by ministering to those in some way or addressing the needs of those who are trapped in poverty. I came to give good news to the poor and relief to the captives, Jesus said. And so clearly Jesus calls us to work toward the release of the poor who are captive to the mindsets and the circumstances and systems that imprison them. And likewise, the mindset and circumstances and systems that imprison the rich, too. We're all in this together. We have our own prisons of sorts. The second request in this Proverbs text to God is, give me neither poverty nor riches. For in my riches I may forget God and say, who is the Lord? Or in my poverty I will dishonor the Lord by stealing. This seems to describe well the dangers of too much or too little. And that is really what the Bible is addressing whenever it's talking about poverty. It's talking about this imbalance between too much and too little and the dangers that has. Those who have too much are prone to the sin of arrogance. Though the word isn't used here, that essentially is what the verse says to the rich. The rich are tempted to think of themselves as deserving, self-made, self-sufficient. Why on earth would I need God? Well, here's the problem. None of these myths are true. Everything has come from God. Nothing belongs to us. The earth is the Lord's and all therein, we are told in the Psalms. And it's not just the things of the earth, but the circumstances we are born into that are from God. Also, the powers we've been given are from God. These two are gifts which God has given us. I don't self-select my family or my country. I didn't birth myself into this time and place. I didn't make my own intelligence or personality. These are all given as gifts with to do with as I will. But I, like you, I am one who desires to live the Christian life. Therefore, it's actually not as I will, but as God wills. The question we ask should be, what can I do with what I have that will be pleasing to God? In our wealth, we can be tempted to forget why we are here. That's why I put on the bulletin board outside this week, be grateful and ponder your mortality. Because we come into this world vulnerable and naked, and that is how we leave this world. I had a little story kind of along this line. Maybe I think too much on mortality. Maybe that's my problem. But anyway, in my neighborhood, a neighbor was going to build, or a land developer was going to build a 15-story high-rise literally off my backyard. And everybody in the neighborhood was up in arms about it. And we were having meetings with the neighbor and so forth, or the developer. And I said to him at the end of one of these meetings, I said, Mr. McDowell, I said, one thing we have, I know we're in dispute over this, but one thing we have in common, in 50 years from now, both you and I are going to be dead. So what's your high-rise going to mean, and what's my house going to mean in that context? Now, that was kind of a cheap shot, I suppose. He said, well, that's kind of a morbid thought. Anyway, that project has been put on hold, and I don't know if it's going to happen. But, you know, perspective. I was just calling perspective. Now, what about the other half of this prayer? It says, in my poverty I may steal and so dishonor the name of God. Now, that's an interesting thing to ponder. This is in reference to the poor, but it also applies to the rich, too. Though this would require a second sermon, it's still worth noting that some people who are wealthy got wealthy essentially by a form of stealing. We still reap the benefits of having kidnapped human beings for 400 years and used their forced labor to build the privileged wealth we have. As children of the colonial conquest, we have to get real and admit we stole indigenous people's lands. That's a heavy thing to think about, but it is true. Take away from me, Lord, all falsehood. Allow me the strength and ability to take in the facts and figure out how I'm going to live with that. Take note of that. But this proverb speaks of the fact that when one is poor and has few options available, the sin of stealing may be seen as the only way to survive in poverty. It's still a sin, mind you. But again, if we are going to honor the proverbial desire to take away all falsehood, we have to be willing to see the poor man's sin for what it is, as a way of surviving. It may be wrong-headed, it may be screwed up and evil, it may be a way whereby the poor exploit the poorer, dog eat dog. That too is the culture of poverty. The weak attacks the weaker. And we need, as a whole nation, to deal with the systematic issues that drive the poor to steal, or to do what we need is, and to do what we need is also to look first at the rich who have stolen. As Woody Guthrie said, some will rob with a six gun and some with a pin. Now, lest you think I'm preaching some kind of partisan liberal bias, I ask you to go to back and read the great Hebrew prophets, Amos, Isaiah, Joel, Hosea, Micah. See how often they speak of poverty and justice. They all saw it.
They saw the sins of systematic justice. Go back and look at the biblical concept of Jubilee in Leviticus 25. That was nothing less than land redistribution based on the reality that due to our sinful nature, wealth gets out of balance from the sin of human greed and individual or tribal selfishness. Lest you think my bias is based on secular liberal politics, first consider why Jesus himself spoke so much of concern for justice and its connection to poverty. You can count them yourself, but 16 out of the 38 parables taught by Jesus speak of concerns regarding wealth. One out of 10 verses in the Gospels deal directly with the subject of money. Jesus' inaugural sermon comes when he opens the book of Isaiah and reads from chapter 61, referring not just to announcing good news to the poor, but also making reference to Jubilee, whereby in this life the clock is reset and the balance is once again attained. Again, I admit it. I am rich. I have choices. Most of us have choices. Therefore, we too are rich. And we can be thankful to God for that. And Jesus isn't asking us, I don't believe, to give everything away like he did to the rich young ruler who wanted to be perfect. I think Jesus is more speaking to us in the model of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, if you remember, is the rich tax collector who had a conversion experience after talking to Jesus, and he agreed. He said, if I have taken anything dishonestly, I will pay it back, and I will give half of what I, pay it back fourfold, I believe, and give away what I half of what I have. Zacchaeus didn't renounce his riches, but he did seek to make and give back what he had gained dishonestly. He became humble. He sought to give out of his abundance so that others who needed it might have more. I want to conclude this sermon. I've probably gone way beyond. By saying that I'm not wanting any of us to feel guilt or shame regarding our poverty or wealth. That's not at all helpful, nor is it my intention. As the character Tavia in the play Fiddler on the Roof famously said when he's contemplating his own poverty, he says, there's no shame in poverty, but there's no great honor either. Likewise, the same could be true with wealth. There's no shame in it. It's a blessing. It is a blessing. It affords us great opportunities to have choice and to be comfortable. But it also affords us great opportunities to share. And that's the joy of being a Christian, a follower of Jesus. This congregation, I want to say, is generous, clearly. It keeps the budget healthy, and it gives over and beyond. This is a giving congregation. Many of you are richly blessed, and you richly give back in return. Some with money, some with time, some with prayer. One small example of generosity and sharing relates just to what happened last night at AMC with some other Christian brothers and sisters. We raised, I had written down here at the time $6,500, but it sounds like almost $8,000 to help rebuild and in the healing for our sisters and brothers in Puerto Rico who have been devastated by Hurricane Maria. And neglected. And that's something. And something is always better than nothing. The Lord is always asking us to do something. And maybe then to do something more on top of that. And when we say, at the end of the day, I did something, then rest assured, by some measure, you have wealth because you have agency. You did something. May God increase our wealth, so that God's desire that all do well may be achieved. As a closing prayer, I ask that we read together again as a personal prayer, Proverbs 30:7-9. So you have that in your bulletin. Why don't we read that together? However, I don't have it in my bulletin, but I have it down here. Let's read that together. I will lead us together. Two things I ask of you, Lord. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. Amen.